Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Chapter 33, Fight and Flight. Harry had no idea what Hermione was planning, or even whether she had a plan. He walked half a pace behind her as they headed down the corridor outside Umbridge's office, knowing it would look very suspicious if he appeared not to know where they were going. He did not dare attempt to talk to her. Umbridge was walking so closely behind them that he could hear her ragged breathing. I'm Matt Potts.
And I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text.
So Matt, we just have two announcements before we hear our story today. The first one being our Every Flavored Bean conversation for patrons only. Harry gets angry in public in a big way in this chapter, and that's our theme. And so we are going to talk about times in which we have gotten angry in public, and we will share these stories not with pride, but with honesty.
I might have some pride. I'm not a person who likes to acknowledge my own anger, and This is a time my anger worked out for the better.
Ooh.
Colette was very happy with me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got a lot of credit from the family when I got angry.
Oh my God. Okay. I can't wait to hear that story. So everybody, you can hear that story by signing up at patreon.com/Harry Potter Sacred Text. And then Matt, we have a special guest today to tell our opening story on the theme of anger. My friend Neil Young, not that Neil Young, Neil J. Young, has a new book coming out called Coming Out Republican. Neil is a writer and an author of We Gather Together, The Religious Right and the Problem of Interfaith Politics. But our listeners might know him from the fantastic true crime podcast, Welcome to Your Fantasy, which is not your typical true crime podcast. It is a gay history true crime podcast. And it's about the corruption behind the Chippendale dancers from the 1980s. And Neil is an incredible writer and podcaster and a good friend whose work I admire so much. And so we invited him to come tell a story on this theme of anger. Hi, Neil. Thank you so much for coming on and telling this story. You have a story for us on the theme of anger. What story do you have for us today?
Hi, Vanessa. Thanks for having me today. My story has a bit of a prologue, which is that I originally misunderstood the assignment. When you reached out to me, you said, come on, we'll talk about your new book. Also, provide me with some themes that we might talk about for this episode. And so I thought that those themes were supposed to come from my book and from the characters that I write about. All right, well, so I provided a long list of things. You picked anger, and then through a series of follow-up emails with one of your producers, I came to understand that really this theme was supposed to be, or ideally was going to be, from my own life, and that my own life would give an accounting of this theme. And our theme is anger today. And if I had known this, this would have been the last theme I would have ever talked about when it comes to me, because I am not someone who gets angry, or rather, I'm someone who is not at all in touch with my anger.
Are you angry at me right now? Because it seems like you might be a little mad at me.
I think it sounds like you're angry at
No, not at Vanessa. All. Yeah. But this was not a boast about myself. This is to say, this is, you know, one of those things I've worked on in therapy. But here we are with a story that's really about anger as I experienced it on behalf of someone else, which was my little dog, Molly, who was the greatest love of my life. She died 6 years ago this week. I came to have Molly when I was only about 24, 25 years old, and I felt like it was this life-altering event. I'd grown up with dogs, but to have my own dog as a young 20-something in New York City was really, for me, the first sort of adult moment of my life. I felt this unbelievable responsibility of caretaking. I also experienced unconditional love in a way that was overwhelming to me. And Molly was the most important thing of my life and truly an obsession. One day I was walking Molly down the street in Manhattan, where I lived for almost 20 years. And this school bus pulled up right next to the sidewalk where I was walking.
I'm already mad.
Molly. Okay, well, it gets worse. All these little kids come racing out of the school bus, and one of them runs up to me and stomps violently on the back of Molly. Now, Molly was about 12 years old at the time. Yes. And it was violent. It was vicious. It was terrifying. My dog was about 12 years old at the time, had gone through not one but two knee surgeries, and I exploded. I lost my mind. I started screaming obscenities, and I think it was mostly initially directed at this kid. A teacher or a school administrator ran over, apologized, and said that, you know, the child didn't mean to do it, and sort of ushered them away really quickly. And I unleashed on this woman, far worse than whatever I had yelled at the kid, basically attacking her for defending the child and saying things like, you know, just wild things like he could have killed my dog. She's had two surgeries, on and on and on and on. And the woman continued with me, trying to sort of smooth it over. And of course, this was one of those moments where there was no smoothing over. I just continued to yell. I'm not sure I've ever yelled at a stranger in my life other than this one moment. And of course, as soon as this was over, I was mortified and embarrassed. I looked around me to see who else on the streets had noticed this, and quickly sort of picked Molly up and ran from the scene in embarrassment at just the way in which I had been overcome by this emotion. But I think that the story might help us explore this line between anger and rage and what it means to tap into anger, especially for those of us who don't feel like it's an emotion we have like a close connection to, when it's on behalf of someone else or something else that means a lot to us. And also what it means when that anger isn't really directed at the proper source, but gets so easily redirected to those people or circumstances that either we think are better able to handle our anger, or just part of our own sort of discomfort with the expression in the first place.
I am so sorry that happened to Molly. You are in really good company. Matt and I are both like dog people with a capital D. And we are dog people who love children and who I think would lose our minds if a child came and stomped on our dog. So I'm just so sorry that happened. And yeah, the clarity of like righteous indignation on someone else's behalf, I think it like has a line around it. And so we can see it more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that makes sense to me that that is one of the simpler ways to tap into anger.
Yeah. You know, if that kid had come off the bus and kicked me in the shin, nothing right. I would have probably apologized to him.
Yeah. And like, that kid's probably going through something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And look at me, how fortunate I am to not, you know, be an 8-year-old kid or, you know, any sorts of things. But in the case of my dog, who was much smaller than this child and who was vulnerable and who was my most important thing to watch over and to protect, it was no surprise that that just came pouring out of me so quickly and so vociferously.
Yeah, Neil, thank you so much for that story. One of the things that's really interesting is like this distinction that you raised for us between like anger and rage. That's something that's coming up, I think, in our book, in book 5 of the Harry Potter series, especially in the last chapter. Like, Harry's full of rage, and it's because someone he loves is in pain, or at least he believes someone he loves is in pain. And that actually leads me to another thing I wanted to remark upon, because you mentioned like now several times that like it's Molly's pain, not your pain, that triggered this anger in you. Interestingly, one of the things I do on the podcast is I think about the etymology of our themes each week. And the like the deep root etymology of the word anger actually comes from the word for pain, a particular kind of pain, like the pain of being like constricted.
Wow.
Or like bound up, like when something is tight and narrow. And the way you describe the story of this experience where like you felt like sort of cornered almost, it seems like.
Yeah.
The way you describe the end of the story where like you looked around and saw people looking at you, like you had only one reaction to the pain of Molly, like it was to erupt in anger. And then you had to escape, right? You had to kind of run away and get out of the situation. But also interestingly, just the how like you can feel the pain of others sometimes more acutely than you feel your own. That when someone you love, some creature you love who is vulnerable, their pain affects you more than your own, right? If you were kicked in the shin, it wouldn't have bothered you the same way that the stomp on Molly affected you. And how anger is just this expression of feeling that pain really acutely.
Neil, can I ask, I know that this wasn't a theme that you necessarily were excited to talk about with your own life, but it's a theme that you said related to your book coming out Republican. And we use these stories in order to ground bigger conversations. I'm wondering why anger was one of the themes that you felt like was really present in your book.
So my book is a history of gay Republicans from the 1950s to present. And anger was a motivating factor of so many of these guys. It's a story almost overwhelmingly about white gay men, especially in the sort of original organizing years of the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, when gay men were coming out of the closet. They were finding each other as Republicans, and they were organizing these grassroots clubs that ultimately in the 1990s became the National Log Cabin Republican Organization that some of you know, your listeners may be familiar with. But these guys were angry. They were angry with what was happening in the nation, the sort of anti-gay politics of the nation, but particularly of those politics happening within their Republican Party, the party that they believed that they were the best representatives of as people who lived free lives, void of government interference. And it pissed them off to no end that these upstart religious conservatives were coming into the Republican Party and taking it away from them and taking the party away from its Lincolnian traditions and pushing it in a different direction into social conservatism. And so anger was really an ongoing theme of what galvanized them, of what motivated their organization, of what kept them active, even when they were disappointed, you know, time and time again by the party, and what kept them from refusing to give up.
So Neil, that's so interesting. What time period does the book cover?
So the book starts in the 1950s in the Cold War era of the Lavender Scare. And I begin in the closet and write about a handful of closeted gay men who are actually central to the founding of modern conservatism. But, you know, when I think about anger and sort of the way in which it relates to the theme of your episode and how it's most apparent in the historical characters I'm writing about, I really see it in the sort of period of the late 1970s through the 1990s and maybe till today, really. But in those organizational moments when these gay Republicans, mostly in California and San Francisco and Los Angeles in the late 1970s, they were coming out of the closet because there was an anti-gay ballot initiative called the Briggs Initiative that was on the 1978 election that would have made it illegal for any public school teacher to be gay or lesbian. It was put forward by this man named John Briggs, who was an Orange County Republican legislator. And these guys were pissed that this person from their own party was seeking to use them and their lives and their livelihood as political fodder for his own career ambitions. He wanted to ultimately be governor of California, and he thought, I'm going to tap into this new thing called the religious right. I'm going to ramp up their fears about the homosexual threat. I'm going to, you know, build this wave and ride this wave of social conservatism to the front of the Republican Party. And these gay men were incensed that someone would come after them, were incensed that anyone would try and remake the Republican Party, and they refused to sort of stand to the side or even to join the Democratic Party and change their politics. They said, no, we're not giving up on the things we believe in, and we're not quitting the party that we belong to and that we best represent.
That's so interesting, Neil, because I would have guessed that the period that you were focusing on was like the Reagan administration, because of the story you initially told, which is this idea of anger on behalf of the vulnerable, anger on behalf of those who are suffering. And when I think about the Reagan administration, I think of sort of the AIDS pandemic and the way that the Reagan administration ignored the suffering, especially of gay men in California, right?
Yeah.
Who were dying and suffering terribly during the AIDS pandemic. Like, I wonder if that also contributed, this sense of anger, like, look at how we are suffering, look at how our party is abandoning us in the moment of our suffering, if that also contributed to the anger.
Yes, that's a big part of the book. I read a whole two chapters about this. But it's an interesting moment because, you know, you said this on the behalf of others. So many of the people in these gay Republican clubs in California, they are HIV positive. And so It's not even necessarily on behalf of others, although plenty of them felt that way about, you know, their friends and colleagues who did have the disease if they didn't have it. But it's a really complicated period of history for gay Republicans that I explore at length in the book, because for a long time, they're justifying Reagan's inaction, saying, well, it's not really the role of the federal government or the president to do stuff here, you know, and he's improving the economy. He's, you know, keeping us safe with his foreign policy engagements. They support him wholeheartedly in his 1984 election bid, even though he does not say the word HIV or AIDS in that first presidential term. But in the second administration, when the disease actually starts to wreak its deadly havoc and people are dying by the thousands, the attitudes there began to change. And also not so much about Reagan, but folks like Pat Buchanan and other far-right figures who really rise to prominence in the second Reagan administration around an anti-gay agenda tied to the HIV/AIDS crisis, they start getting really angry about this. A lot of, like I said, a lot of them die. It's a real turning point in my story because so many of these guys don't survive past this period. But those who do, many of them leave the Republican Party. They quit their involvement in these gay Republican organizations because they think, okay, this party has really abandoned us. Not only has it abandoned us, it's demonized us. And so it is a moment, it's an important historical moment in the overall narrative I'm sketching here. But even then, the anger is not really directed at Reagan as much as it is a lot of the folks around him. And in some ways, I think we can often, like I said, redirect our anger away from the source, or at least find other sources that maybe are easier to express that anger towards.
Yeah. I have a theory that I just came up with, so this is not vetted. And it's in response, Neil, to these two stories that you've told concurrently, the stories from your book and about Molly. Is it possible that one of the things that angers us the most, or that the incident that anger is most tied to, is a sense of invisibility, right? Like, if you think of anger as loud externally, right? Like, you're yelling. It's, you didn't see the vulnerability of Molly, right? Like, you don't see us as Republicans because we're gay. You don't see that we're dying. And I think that we see that in this chapter too. Harry gets really mad when people have lost sight of their goal, that they're like on this adventure to save Sirius, right? And that anger is a response to feeling invisible. Does that seem right?
I think that seems absolutely right, especially as it's expressed in its form of rage, right? Like, wake up, people, you know, pay attention. And that the sort of response to feeling invisible is to overcorrect with something that shakes everyone into recognition, right?
And anger is inappropriate often under this guise because people feel as though they're entitled to more space than they're actually entitled to, right? Mm-hmm. We think about people screaming in cars and it's like, Well, yeah. You're not actually entitled to go faster than everybody else. Like, this is how traffic works, right? But yeah, rage that Molly's vulnerability isn't being seen, rage that you, like, believe in a libertarian point of view of freedom and that your voice isn't being heard anymore because of your sexual orientation, right? Like, even when they are rages that I disagree with, right, on a policy level, like, that's a rage that I really do understand, of, like, something coming from within you and trying to make the invisible visible.
Yeah.
Don't you think it's something more, maybe even more fundamental than that, just, like, sort of being made insignificant, right? Like,
yeah.
Invisibility can be an attribute of one's insignificance, but if this child had accidentally stepped on Molly's back foot because this child hadn't just actually not seen Molly, that's different than the child seeing Molly and deciding this creature is not worth my attention,
right,
and I can kick it or stomp it. Yeah, and so invisibility is a common attribute of insignificance, but there's a particular cruelty to seeing you and, like, deciding that I see you and I don't care, right?
Yep, that's a better word. Thank you.
I think that's absolutely the case with the gay Republicans I'm talking about, because actually, if anything, they wanted to be invisible. Like, but by the nature of their sort of conservatism, they didn't believe in identity politics, right?
Right.
So they just didn't want it held against them. Like, let me live my life. Like, on one of their newsletters, they had, you know, something along the lines of keeping the government out of my bedroom and out of my wallet, right? Leave us alone. Yeah. Don't pay. This should not be something that is paid attention to, because it doesn't matter. I'm a tax-paying, law-abiding, you know, citizen. Don't bring something of my quote-unquote private life into the public realm. However, if you go after me for that thing that I am seeking to actually keep unseen out of the public eye, that I'm not, you know, forcing upon you or anyone else, and not only if you're going after it through sort of discriminatory legislation, but that if you're demonizing us at our most vulnerable, when we're sick and dying, then the response to that is anger. And that anger is not, again, grounded in having felt invisible. It's in having been made visible in order to persecute and ruin their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, the inconsequence being made explicit.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Neil, thank you so much. I know that it wasn't the kind of story you wanted to tell, but it really allowed me to understand anger in a totally different way. So I'm really grateful to you, and congratulations on your book. Your journalism is always incredible. And so we will link to your book in all of the places. But in the meantime, everybody, his book is called Coming Out Republican, A History of the Gay Right. Neil, thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Neil.
Thank you so much. I never knew I would be so happy to speak about anger, but it has been a delight.
Bye, Neil. Thanks. Okay, Matt, we're going to recap the chapter, Something That Never Makes You Angry, recapping.
Never angry.
On your mark, get set, go.
So they walk out of the place and into the woods, and they're going into the woods, and Harry's like, where's Hermione going? And Hermione's like, let's keep going. And Harry's like, why are we going so far? And she's like, just wait, we're gonna get there. And then the centaurs come, and then there's a big thing, and there's arrows flying, and they grab what's her name, and then
Umbridge.
Yeah, that's right, Umbridge. And then Harry's they get an argument with it, like, oh, don't hurt us, please don't hurt us. And then Grop shows up, and Grop's very angry, and then the other children show up after Grop runs off, and they're like, let's go to the place, we'll use the thestrals. I couldn't remember Umbridge's name for like 10 seconds, and that really compromised my summary. Okay, let me count you in.
Okay.
3, 2, 1, go.
So they take Umbridge into the Forbidden Forest, and she starts saying really racist things about centaurs, and so the centaurs take her off, and then they're like, the kids are like, don't get us, we love you, and he's like, you're using us too. But then Grop comes, and Grop is like, I miss Hagrid, Hermie, and they're like, and then they get away, and then because Ginny, Neville, and Luna show up, and they bring wands, and they got away, and they're like, here's thestrals, let's all get on the thestrals, and Harry doesn't want the other tree to come, but looks like they're all going.
That was excellent.
Thank you.
See, I think you got over the hump right at the beginning. You just said Umbridge to start, and then you didn't spend 15 seconds trying to remember her name. So Vanessa, there's a lot of anger in this chapter.
Yeah.
Lots of folks are angry. I think I kind of want to start inspired by Neil's book, because maybe the most obvious, like, instance of anger in this chapter is the centaurs, right? But they're angry for so many reasons, and it's not just a single offense that they're angry about. They're angry about like a kind of a systematized injustice or an ideology that frames everything that's going on. So in the chapter, as you very eloquently recapped, Harry and Hermione and Umbridge are going into the Forbidden Forest. Now, we've heard already in this book that the Centaurs are upset about what's going on between the wizards and the Centaurs, and that they're upset about what Hagrid was doing there. They're upset about Grop. They're upset about Firenze going to Hogwarts. There's all kinds of anger and upset going on in the community. But in the single instance of what's going on now, they're just kind of, you could say that the Centaurs are upset about an instance of trespassing. They don't want Umbridge and Hermione and Harry walking into land that they believe is theirs. It's like the single thing. Like, you have done something wrong. We are angry at you. But when the Centaurs confront Umbridge and Harry and Hermione, and Umbridge starts saying, as you said in your recap, like, wizarding supremacist things, like, I guess racist. I'm not sure racist is the right term, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, things towards the Centaurs.
Bad vibes.
Yeah, talking about how they're I think she calls them half-breeds.
That the land is only theirs because the Ministry of Magic gave it to them.
Exactly. Language that really echoes the way that in this country, right, the U.S. federal government has spoken about the land that it stole from indigenous people in this country, right? You can see, all this other stuff. And then their anger is not like, you trespassed here once. It just taps into this trespass as sort of emblematic of a long history of wizards dismissing the intelligence, the worth, the dignity of Centaurs, and also of their relationship to their land and to their own traditions, right? And then it becomes then they get really angry, right? They're already angry, and that anger is with respect to this particular instance of trespassing, but it's always connected to a larger offense. And once Umbridge starts talking, it exposes all this other stuff. What's really interesting, though, is after they carry Umbridge off, the conversation continues between a handful of the Centaurs, including this gray Centaur who seems particularly angry. And Harry and Hermione, even though their intentions are better, also can't help but seem to get caught up in the same kind of language. They can't actually say anything without them also appearing to have instrumentalized the Centaurs or have used them or to be folding themselves into this longer history of injustice, which makes the Centaurs really angry, right? And so that is the tension and the violence that we see in this chapter. It's all rooted in this sort of generational, institutional, systemic anger that's arising from the Centaurs.
Yeah. So many things to say about that. I love your last point that I didn't totally articulate to myself, that the kids, they don't have access to words that aren't supremacist, right?
Yeah.
It is in their language. The only way they know how to talk is in a certain framework. And God, I understand that, right? That moment when you realize that you're only speaking in a supremacist framework, but you don't have the vocabulary to not do it. And that frustration at yourself. But to watch the anger, standing there and feeling so insignificant that someone can't even think of the right words to describe you.
I think it's even more than language. I think it's, they just are wizards. Right? It's not, the reason they don't have the language is because whether they intended it or not, they are part of a system that has exploited and harmed these Centaurs, right? And so, again, this is why you can't abstract the narrow instance of the one thing from the larger system. You can't abstract the narrow instance of the trespass from the larger betrayal and injustice. And in this case, we as readers can see they're children who are trying to escape a person who's going to torture them. Of course it was fine for them to walk into the woods. Right. But for the Centaurs, the story is never that narrow. It's never that small. The story is always more. It's always everything else. And all that's true too. And so the reason they don't have the language is not because the language has failed. It's because that's just who they are. It just is the history that they can't help but carry with them. Right. Yeah.
Right.
And you're right. I totally feel that. totally understand that in many of my own privileges, right? Yeah.
Yeah, where I live right now is Massachusetts land, right? And then I'm like, but this this is where I live, right? Like, I live in this paradigm, and how do I make myself less complicit, or how do I just acknowledge complicity, right? And I think, you know, we honed in on insignificant, but I do think obviously there are other things that can make us angry. And this is something that you and I have talked about a lot just between us, about when things are unclear, the most tempting thing to do is just take a side and pretend that it's clear, right? And I think that the centaurs see that it's never as clear as the wizards think it is, right? That like, we are in a generations long battle for this land. It's not just about you needed a safe place for tonight.
Yeah.
Right. Like, there were other quote unquote safe places you could go. You decided that this is one that you just have access to.
Yeah. And also that they're not wrong. I mean, like,
right.
Hermione's strategy was, I bet the centaurs will
take care of this for me.
Will take care of this for us. And which is like, again, for a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, whatever she is, in the narrow concrete instance, like, that's not a bad thing. It's not an unjust thing, right? But you can completely see how the centaurs would be like, yep, once again,
just using us.
Yeah. Not honoring like what we think is important, right? Like,
yeah, absolutely. Is part of Hermione's strategy, though, also that the backup is that Grop is there?
Yeah, I think maybe. I'm right. I mean, I guess I'm assuming that she's thinking the centaurs are the ones who will do it.
I'm thinking both.
But she's, yeah, I just think that she's so scared of Grop that she's,
yeah,
maybe worried about getting too close to Grop herself, right? She's not sure that right. Grop will be as discriminating as the centaurs will be. But I think you're right. I think that she just knows that there are powerful things in the forest that can give them an opportunity to escape.
Yeah. But what's interesting about Grop, right, is she is right that Grop isn't as nuanced in his attack. But I think part of that is because I would argue that what he's in isn't anger. It's just pain. He's just in pain and feels insignificant and misses Hagrid and is just like tied up in the middle of the woods. But he's also feeling like grief and alone. And I think often when I'm in pain, the first feeling I reach for is anger, right? Because otherwise I get scared, which I think is worse than anger in a lot of ways, right? Like, fear is more uncomfortable than anger, and feeling vulnerable is more uncomfortable than feeling angry. I would argue, I don't know if you agree, part of what's beautiful about Grop is like, he's just stating these fact feelings, right? Like, where is Hagrid? I miss Hagrid, right? Like, yeah. It's not anger, right? Like, it's just like this pure feeling.
I think that's right. But I think, you know, as the etymology of anger shows us, like, I think there's not a bright line between anger and pain, right? Like,
right.
And interestingly, like, you also use the language of grief. In Old English, the word that eventually becomes anger in modern English actually meant something more like grief or confusion, right?
Whoa.
And that's something we really do see in Grop here, right? He doesn't know where Hagrid went. He kind of knows. He remembers Hermes' name, right? He kind of knows that these folks were supposed to help take care of him.
Yeah.
He kind of has that sense because Hagrid has told him this, but he also doesn't know how they're supposed to care for him. And so there's a lot of confusion. And I think that's why the gap between his confusion and pain and grief and his rage is so narrow here. I mean, it's an important gap. I mean, it's arrows being shot at his face, right? Like, those that can take you to anger pretty quickly,
right,
if you're in confusion. But I also think, you know, and this is what I believe the children are probably afraid of before the arrows start flying, that if Hermione and Harry can't give him a good answer of where Hagrid is, he also might escalate into some kind of rage, right? And it's just kind of their luck that the centaurs provoke him to attack them first, rather than their inability to give him a good answer provoking him into the kind of anger that, you know, provoking him to cross that narrow gap between something like pain and grief and confusion and anger.
Yeah, and that is one of the scary things about anger, right? Is when you're around someone who you don't know what will set them off, right?
Yeah.
If you're around someone who gets angry when there are arrows flying at their face, you're like, do you know what? That's reasonable. Or
yeah,
like,
I will not shoot arrows at your face.
Yeah, that seems okay. Or
right,
when your dog gets stomped on, right?
That's
like,
right.
I will not stomp on your dog.
Right.
But the scary thing about anger is when, if I don't have the right answer for you, you might get angry and I'm not sure what the right answer is.
Yeah. When I first went in the Navy, like, you know, the commanding officer on a ship usually has a ton of power. Like, the slogan they have in the Navy, it's the only true monarch still in the world, is the captain of a Navy ship at sea. Because really, you're out by yourself in the middle of the ocean and they really can do what they want, at least until they get back to port. And so there's a lot of conversation among sailors about, like, what makes a good captain and what makes a bad captain. And they have what are called screamers, like captains who are angry a lot of the time, who do a lot of screaming. And they're bad, but what I learned pretty quickly in the Navy is that worse than a screamer is an unpredictable screamer.
Yeah.
If you know what makes them scream, you just don't do that.
Yeah.
Right? But if anything, if different things make them scream at you every day, then you're just always terrified because you don't know what's going to set them off. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think it has to be a never screamer, right?
Exactly. Right.
Like somebody who just like gets fed up eventually once in a while, but like because someone stomps on their dog, right? Like, I don't want to say like you can never be angry, which I know isn't what you were saying.
Yeah,
but
right.
Yeah, there's a fine line between wanting to make sure that everybody has permission to feel anger and knowing that, yeah, it's our responsibility to not make our anger other people's problem, even though often our anger is about trying to feel significant again.
Yeah, or it's about making it the right person's problem. I mean, that was also
the right person's problem.
That was also Neil's story, right? Yeah.
Right, absolutely.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
So speaking of making it the right person's problem, tell me about Harry in this chapter.
So Harry, at the end of this chapter, I mean, Harry is pissed at the whole end of this chapter, which,
he's been pissed,
you know,
for a few
God
chapters.
Bless.
He's been pissed for the whole book, really.
I feel like he's been pissed since he, you know, got dropped off at the Dursley's house and like always fair, right? But there's a moment that I find so interesting as far as what we were talking about with Neil and the etymology and Harry in this chapter, which is that he gets mad at Hermione for this obviously brilliant plan.
Yeah.
Like, Hermione got them out of Umbridge's office and away from Umbridge and had Umbridge taken away. Like, she, like, tick, 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 did this brilliant thing.
Yeah.
And he, right, is like, the thing he wants to feel significant is that Sirius is gonna die. And, like, that is the thing to keep visible right now and to keep significant to him right now. And Hermione didn't lose track of that, but she had to zigzag. And she zigzagged too far away for Harry's comfort. And he is livid. And he is just mad at the wrong person. The thing to be mad at is Umbridge and, right, like all these things. And I, Neil mentioned this a little bit, but the times in our lives where we're just angry and so we put it on the wrong person, like what you were just saying, Hermione is not the enemy, Harry.
That's right. She's just eating the elephant one bite at a time, right? Like the first thing we got to do is get out of this mess. We can't do anything until we do that. And she basically figures out the only way to do that.
Yeah.
Right? And he's like, smart plan, Hermione. And I'm like, yeah, it was a smart plan. Brilliant.
Actually.
Hermione, right. They're out in the forest. They're not at the castle, so it's not as easy to get to the ministry. But they are in a much better place than they were in the castle, in the custody of Dolores Umbridge, right? So, yeah.
And it turns out that because of Luna's thestral idea, they're actually closer getting to London.
That's right. And the blood that's all over them because of Hermione's idea is drawing the thestrals. I mean, Hermione couldn't have planned this better. Harry.
So, Matt, this week we are continuing with our sacred reading practice of Chavruta. As you know, the way Chavruta works is I'm going to ask a question, but I'm also going to answer the question. You will respond to my question and answer, and then you will offer your own question and answer. So Hermione says in this chapter, well, we can't do anything without her wands, hopelessly dragging herself up again. Here's my question. I mean, is that true? I mean, it's obviously not true. The Thestrals come and, like, they get out. Their wands also come back because Ron and Luna and Ginny and Neville show up. But this feeling that Hermione has, right, of, like, we can't do anything without our wands is interesting because Umbridge is now gone. They can run back up to the castle, right? Like, the castle is no longer a scary place. Draco doesn't have any authority without Umbridge there, right? Like, this feeling of, like, we don't have our tool and therefore there's nothing we can do is actually a really limiting thought for Hermione. And I'm thinking, right, like, obviously I'm thinking about my phone as my wand, right? Or, like, internet, you know, of, like, can we even play a game or have fun? Like, what can we even do? Is anything knowable without these things? And, right, like, having to remind ourselves of the things that we can do without our phones and the things that we can do without the internet. But, you know, it's just so interesting to me. I mean, this question, she says it is such a fact, and the narrative agrees with it, right? Because, like, the next page, it's like, don't worry, you have your wands. Ron is here with your wand, and so everything is fine. And it just really distracts them from the fact that, like, Grubbly Plank is right there. Flitwick is right there, right? Like, everybody other than Umbridge, even Snape, is, like, actually an ally. And so the fact that they, like, get their wand/phones back actually causes this huge problem. This over-reliance on a technology of wands causes a problem.
I love that because, of course, I was thinking about phones also. I was just in Japan. And it's hard to say how much easier it is to navigate around Japan when one has Google Maps, which has, you know, Japan's a very elaborate and complicated and convenient public transit system. But there are lots of train lines. They all come at different times. They connect in different ways. And you can just look for directions on your phone. It'll tell you not just, like, which train to connect to, but, like, which car to get into so the transfer is easiest to the next line, which exit to take. You know, we go to a train station that literally has 37 exits. Because it's such a huge train station, it'll say, go to this exit, because that'll get you to the place you're going most quickly. It's super convenient. And I had to remind myself that I lived in Japan 20 years ago, and I did all this without a phone.
Right.
Right? Because my wireless wasn't working one day, and I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I'm not connected to the internet. How am I going to get anywhere? And I was like, oh, I have done this before. Like, there are maps on the walls. And there are notices everywhere in English, and I can do this.
And also, if you get off at the wrong exit, you can walk an extra tenth of a mile.
You figure it out. It works.
Yeah.
Right. So that's exactly what I was thinking. And so I agree with your answer. It really reminds me, I don't know if it's like a direct relationship, but like in tone or content or something of like the conversation we were having at the beginning of our theme with respect to Hermione and Harry, like not being able to respond to the Centaur's accusation.
Yeah.
There's something that ties these two things together. The fact that they can't imagine that they have any power without their wands.
Yeah.
And them being kind of unable to recognize how their wizarding identities or wizarding privilege situates them in that forest. There's something about them not being able to see themselves without that power, right? So I guess my question and response is going to ask us to turn back to that encounter with the centaurs. Like, would things have been different if they had just kind of acknowledged that they were in the wrong?
Yeah.
Instead of protesting and saying, you know what, we had a right to do it because we were in trouble and we didn't want to exploit you, but it's not that bad, right? Because we did get free and it didn't really inconvenience that much. If they had just said, you know, you're right, we were wrong, we're sorry.
Yeah.
Please don't hurt us.
Right.
Right. Like, but kind of put down their wands. Right?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, like, you know, we are wizards, but wizards are actually really good and we use our powers for good. Not every wizard's a bad wizard. Some wizards are good wizards and the good wizards can take advantage of you, right? Like they had.
Yeah. We feel real bad about it.
Yeah. So that's my question. Would it have made a difference?
Yeah.
My answer is, I don't think so. But it still might have been the right thing to do, right? Like it may not have made a practical difference, but maybe a moral difference, right? I think So maybe no difference in a practical level. I think the centaurs might have still been mad. It might have still taken Grop intervening to get them free of the centaurs or to get them out of the way of the centaurs' anger. But it still would have made a difference because I think it's a better position or posture for them to take.
Yeah, which I think like matters on a soul level and also just like very selfishly or very, not selfishly, but shallowly. Like you don't know. There's like some centaur listening that 5 years from now is going to be like, right? Yeah. Like these kinds of moments of reaching out really do make a difference.
Yeah. And maybe my answer is too cynical because we can see that there's at the beginning of the conversation, there's some of the centaurs that want to be forgiving towards Hermione and Harry.
Right.
And there are a couple who don't.
They're just kids.
And as they keep talking, they start to swing opinion the wrong way. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Matt, thank you so much for a great spiritual practice.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This week's voicemail is from Brittany.
Hello, Vanessa, Matt, Casper, and the whole Harry Potter and the Sacred Text team, Ariana, AJ. You guys are incredible. I loved the question about Parvati. So much of the magic in the Harry Potter world seems to originate from inside one's imagination, to me. For example, Dumbledore just summons a chintz chair, or Lily's elegant flower petal changing into a fish. But this magic, where Parvati is curling her eyelashes with her wand, it reminded me of how witches, and I'm thinking specifically female witches, have used practical objects of their household, like broomsticks and herbs, to infuse with magic. So to me, this is Parvati showing a resourcefulness and a playfulness by using her wand. I don't think the wand's circumference is as much curling her lashes as is magic, but I do think it's like a combination of the two. Thanks for that question, and thank you so much for all of your work.
Brittany, I love this reflection. I love two parts of it. One is that, you know, women, especially women of color over the history of the world, have had to use products not designed for them and for their bodies in order to be quote unquote beautiful, but also just like in order to have a body and take care of your body, right? We've seen even in the last 10 years, more shades of makeup coming out to match different skin tones, as if for a long time, there was like this mainstream idea that only white people needed makeup, right? And I love this claim that, of course, like people are constantly coming up with ways to take care of their bodies in ways that, you know, commerce hasn't sort of caught up with them. Patriarchy and institutionalized racism, obviously creating a lot of commerce. And then I also love your point that magic is only limited by your imagination. You know, I think that that's absolutely right. That's something that Ariana Nettleman talks about a lot of, you know, what is the magic symbolizing here? What is the magic doing here? And I think that magic is often expressing something deep about someone and something almost vulnerable about someone, because you are seeing that deep imagination within them when they are, you know, using a spell in a way that one wouldn't typically use a spell, which is like where great power is. So just thank you so much for these reflections. I'm so grateful to you for being one of our listeners and for adding to our conversation.
Now is the time in our podcast when we remember those in our community who have been loved and lost. Mark Longoria, 47, a beloved band director and a much missed friend. Marigold Grace Thorup, who was only 43 minutes old, a beloved daughter, baby sister, and granddaughter. Nex Benedict, who was 16, a nature lover, reader, and artist. Tim Smith, 75, a dedicated husband, a generous brother, and a goofy uncle. Mary Elizabeth Keys Butita, who is also known as Zaya, 31, a daughter, friend, and fierce protector of the environment. Let light perpetual shine upon all of them. Vanessa, who are you blessing this week?
I am going to bless Ron. Ron is just there with his fat lip, and he's so proud of himself, and he's so game, and he just like wasn't going to stop until he got to Hermione and Harry. And I love people who won't stop until they get to their people. You know, I'm obsessed with a lot of these stories, like Elizabeth Smart or the movie Reds, or I just love stories about people who are like, well, I will homeward break down bound. Walls. Homeward Bound.
Yes.
Love that movie. It's an important film. The Journey of Natty Gann. Like, I just love stories about people who are like, I am not stopping until I get to my person. And I don't think I realized until this chapter. I mean, he does a version of this in book seven, but in book seven, it's his fault that he separated. But here we see, right, like, mm-hmm. this kid's not going to stop until he gets to his people. I flipping love that, Matt. I love it.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think mine is a little bit connected to yours. Because I want to bless Grop. And the reason I wanted to bless Grop is because he's confused and frightened. And I get it. Like, right? He's like, he's been taken away from the only home he's ever known. It's a home where he was mistreated, but still it's the only home he's ever known.
Totally.
In this way, it's, you know, very much like Harry, right? And dropped into this place where the only support he has is Hagrid, right? And Hagrid's now gone and he's feeling at sea or lost or in the woods, literally, right? And I just feel bad for him. He doesn't know why he's there. He doesn't know where Hagrid went. He doesn't know how to care for himself or what's next for him. It just makes me feel sorry for him. And that's why I wanted to bless him. But then when you were talking about your blessing for people who are not going to stop until they get to the person they're going after, right? That's also Grop. Grop is going to find Hagrid.
Yeah, he
is. We know it. Whatever else happens, Grop's going to find Hagrid. So we can bless Grop for that as well.
Next week, we're going to be reading Book 5, Chapter 34, The Department of Mysteries, through the theme of success, with the wonderful Jolie Doggett. Before we do our credits, we have to make an announcement. Our Don't Be a Dursley fundraiser went so incredibly well this year. Our listeners, you, our community, just continue to blow us away with your generosity and support. And we were able to raise over $12,000 for the incredible organization On the Rise because of you. And several of you donated over $100. And we are just going to say your names briefly to lift up your generosity and say a thank you. But we are just grateful to everybody who was able to contribute at all. And just thank you for helping make our work a little bit more meaningful by participating in efforts like this. So Nancy Wood, Laura Dong, Fauna Larkin, Jennifer Fontan, Hannah Albert,
Sammy Lavin, Barbara Moran-Fail, Danny Langley, Catherine Danko, Vardit and Richard Samuels,
Donna J. Hoff, Aaron Johnson, Catherine L. Keeney, Don Amesbury,
Kyra Thoreau Barto, Erica L. French, Diana Leary, Cody Brown, Elizabeth M. Schweinsberg,
Kristen Romine, Stephanie Paulsell, Brandis Roberts, Elizabeth Morash, and one of my best friends, Emmy Wigglemuth, who's about to get married. I just get to go to her wedding soon. So thank you, everybody. And, you know, Mazel Tov, Emmy. Just a few reminders before we give our thanks. Our big class, What Matters, is open for registration right now. This is a year of reflecting and learning. You can find out more at notsorryworks.com.
This has been a Not Sorry production, and Not Sorry Productions is a feminist production company. Our executive producers are Caitlin Hoffmeister and Vanessa Zoltan. We are edited and produced by AJ Yaramas. Our music is by Ivan Paisau and Nick Bull, and we are distributed by Acast.
We'd like to thank Brittany for sending in their voicemail this week. Neil Young for coming on and telling a story. Neil's book, Coming Out Republican, is out now. Everybody go get it. It's fascinating. Ariana Nottelman, Julia Argy, Margaret H. Wilson, Nikki Zoltan, Hannah Rehack, Casper Turk, Kyle, Courtney Brown, Natalie Folkert, Svidius Reyes, and Stephanie Paulsell, and everyone who sent in the names of their loved ones. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you next week. What's our every flavored bean today? A time you met a giant in the woods. An experience you had in the woods.
Really?
No.